The Lab takes the ethereal to the practical. Our podcast acts like a business school case study for private equity professionals, CEOs, operating partners, and chief transformational officers. We all know transformation is the key to differentiated alpha. Here's how you actually do it. Our audience tunes in to learn from those in the field, getting their fingernails dirty and driving meaningful growth through better operations, technology, and data. We learn from going to business school, teaching at business schools, and applying these lessons in the real world that case studies actually help the insight stick better. Come join us.
Hey, and welcome back to the next episode here of the podcast, the Lab Podcast. As usual, Nick and I are talking to someone we think is, you know, quite interesting from their background and adding value inside the portfolio company. So excited to have Paul Stancic here with us today at Parker Gale. But, you know, I think what we can do to kick it off is, you know, one of the things I've liked about Paul is you don't get too many great athletes, former, you know, model types slash those folks that get into private equity. They don't come in the same package all the time, but, you know, Paul's the exception to all these rules. But maybe we'll kick off, Paul, with how you got into private equity, your path, and then how you've helped Parker Gale think about the systems and the playbooks that are necessary to drive real value in the portcos. But what goes on when it doesn't go to plan? Because rarely is the model perfect from day one to day 100 to day 1000. So why don't we start with your background and dig in?
Yeah, after that introduction, I thought I was just going to have to introduce myself, but now I feel like I have to explain myself. So thanks for that, Scott. Yeah, Paul Stancic, happy to be here. I appreciate you guys having me on. I'm an operating partner here at Parker Gale Capital. We're a small PE fund. We're headquartered in the West Loop of Chicago, and we buy founder-owned B2B software businesses. And our team, we're basically half investors, half operators. Our investing team, they're the folks that handle finding, executing, monitoring the companies from a financial perspective. They're the ex-bankers, the ex-consultants, and they spend most of their time looking at 100 companies for every one that we decide to partner with. And then there's the operating team, which I'm a part of. And we're Parker Gale's in-house consulting team. And when I think about what we do every day, I think we are basically here to help our companies finish the work that the founder started. And I run our growth practice. And what that means is I spend most of my time working with some combination of our CEOs, CMOs, CROs to do things like train their teams, position their products, monitor their performance, and build the campaigns and plans of attack that help them find new customers. And I also do a lot of writing about sales, marketing, growth, leadership. If you Google my name, that stuff should pop right up. If you're interested in how I think about the world, or your Ambien just hasn't kicked in yet, you need some help falling asleep. But yeah, I'm happy to talk about how I landed here. I think that I've had two experiences in my career that have really brought me to Parker Gale. I'm happy to talk about the fact that I'm a washed up lacrosse player, but in the world of finance, that's neither unique nor interesting. I'd say the two big experiences that have shaped my career and brought me here. One, very early in my career, I made a pivot to sales and ended up selling stuff to hedge funds for about 4 or 5 years. Two things interesting about that. One is I think it's just a fascinating market and it's a tough one to get people to pay attention to you. So I feel like I learned a lot of important lessons from that. And second, that was the timing of it. This was in the teeth of the financial crisis. So when you think about the ideal cold call that you could ever possibly make that you would be excited about, 2008, 2009, trying to get a hedge funder to pick up the phone and pay attention to you probably isn't what you would draw up. So happy to talk about that. Before I got to Parker Gale, I spent 5 years at Bain & Company. And that was just the perfect finishing school for me coming out of business school. I felt like my biggest frustration in my early sales career was I didn't have a whole lot of opportunities or experiences to be analytical, strategic, to dig into the numbers. And Bain was the environment that not only provided that for me, it demanded that of me. And it also let me continue kind of the buffet of business school to figure out what tasted good. And it led me to Parker Gale, which has been the best move that I've made in my career so far.
So do you think that process, I mean, it's classic business school, right? Where you go and when you either in your summer, you come out and you go into a consulting shop or a bank or whatnot. That was a nice pivot for you. Because what we find, we're placing operating partners, having spent a fair amount of time at the Bains or the BCGs and the McKinseys of the world, is a great place, as you use sort of a finishing school to sort of be thoughtful, where you're being strategic, but then you need to flip it into being practical. And I think, you know, maybe that's an interesting transition to, you can have all the, you know, the Mike Tyson quote, you got a plan till you get punched in the face, right? So things go wrong often. So, you know, how do you think about the systems and the playbooks that you put together and what you've learned, but also being thoughtful about you need to pivot? Because I feel like that's something you've done a nice job with at Parker Gale.
I think working for a small sales team early in my career, and I started as the first BDR before BDRs were even called BDRs, right? And I've written all about this in my series, Why Sales Sucks. Like, I showed up to a situation where I was basically given the equivalent of a phone and a machete and said, you know, good luck, kid, too, and eventually figured it out. But the point is, I had to figure out how to make it happen with very few resources in my first go-to-market role. And I think part of the reason I like doing what I'm doing today, and part of the reason I really enjoyed my management experience within sales, was kind of saving people from that same fate of showing up with no training, no onboarding, no enablement, no idea who to call, what to say, or how to avoid sounding like everybody else. Back to your question about kind of the value of consulting and how that plays into preparing you for or positioning you for an operating partner role, I think the best operators, period, and the best operating partners, they're very good at two things. One is creating clarity about what to do, but two is about actually making it happen. And for me, I feel like early in my career, I learned how to make it happen by showing up to a company with a very good product in actually a very good market, but, you know, not a lot of structure or process, and I had to create a lot of that. I'd say what my time at Bain provided me was a much better apprenticeship around, you're stepping into a chaotic situation, you need to very quickly come up with a diagnosis of everything that's going on, what the actual complication is, what the most critical problem or question that you need to answer is, and get everyone on the same page about what those things are so that you can move forward. And I do think that if you have one without the other, if you're able to accomplish a lot when a task is put in front of you, but you don't have that ability to diagnose and create clarity about what the actual problem is and what to do about it, that could be a not so great situation. But if you're a really great strategic thinker, but you've never actually had to do the grunt work to move the ball forward, that's also not going to serve you quite as well. So from a career perspective, if I had to do it over again, I'm not sure that I would change much, first of all, but I would seek out kind of a two-pronged experience where I had a chapter of my career where I really had to go make something happen and bring order from the chaos, and another chapter of my career where someone was teaching me how to get really good at that strategic diagnosis and figure out, okay, there's a lot going on, but this is the most important problem and the highest point of leverage that we can go attack.
That's awesome. I think your background's pretty interesting. And I think that what you're just talking about is going to touch on a little bit of your approach at PE Ops for Parker Gale, especially when we get into focus, quantity, and quality. But before we even get into that, let's kind of just talk about what you guys consider most important as you're onboarding new companies and then your role specifically, but really your guys' larger approach.
Yeah, I think the important thing to realize for us is, like, this is not venture capital. Like, if you asked me to guess what the next big technological wave is going to be before it happens, I'm going to give you just that, a guess, and it's probably not going to be a very good one. So the companies that we invest in, they've often been around for 5, 10, 20 years. And the fun part about that for us is that makes our work not a hypothesis, but a regression. And we can look back and pick out what the business looks like when it's at its best and what its best customers look like and where the goodness is that we can go not invent, but amplify. So I sometimes like to say we tend to follow the Dolly Parton school of operational improvement. And she's got a great quote about, you know, I think about music and life and maybe not intentionally about private equity, but it sure as hell works in my opinion. Her advice is you should find out who you are and then do it on purpose. And so everything that we do at Parker Gale, but definitely everything we do in the ops team, I think is designed to uncover what the company and its products and its people already look like when they're at their best, and then do that a little more intentionally and just a little faster, right? And sometimes we'll talk about the fact that what we're doing is finishing the work that the founder started, right? And part of the reason that people like to partner with us is they recognize they've built an amazing business, but they want someone who's going to help them finish what they started a long time ago, close the gaps that they recognize and they're very forthcoming about are still there, while still respecting and honoring what's great about it. And so I'm happy to talk about what that looks like specifically and from a playbook perspective. But I think it's important to realize, like, we're actually not inventing too much that's new. What we're trying to do is just be a little more consistent about how the company is already executing when they're doing things right. And the good news is we invest in companies where there's a lot of good stuff already happening.
Being a student of the game, do you think how you guys support your companies is unique?
I think so. You know, there's a lot of operating teams out there. There's a lot of private equity funds out there. There's a lot of people that follow the same like 30,000 foot level of kind of operating model that we do, which is have folks that are good at both the diagnosis and getting things done and have folks that are roughly mapped to the functional areas of the company like we are. You know, we have someone that focuses on product and engineering, someone who focuses on office of the CFO. You got me who focuses on growth. I think the biggest difference and the biggest point of uniqueness for us is more stylistic. We like to say that, you know, we do things with people, not to people. And if you think about the spectrum of other folks that do what we do, I think it exists on a spectrum of very prescriptive, like thou shalt follow the playbook or else, or very artisanal, like it completely depends on the situation and we're not going to bother writing too much stuff down. I think what we're uniquely good at is having a strong opinion on the more or less timeless principles that always seem to work, but also recognizing how important it is to put those principles in the handwriting of each one of our companies and get good at recognizing what the team is ready for and what they're not ready for, right? So when you think about what I do all day, it's kind of the same stuff with every company. Like if I can get our companies to be a little more focused on the customers who buy quickly and happily and lucratively, and then they stick around and expand, and if we can get better at tracking how many conversations we need to have with those people to get to the bookings number that we need, and if I'm helping our team QA the sales and marketing process so that when we do get that precious next conversational opportunity with someone who just might buy, we're a little more confident and more effective in that conversation. That's kind of what I'm doing at every company. But it's about, again, weaving it into what the team is ready for, what they're excited about, because that's the stuff that's going to stick. And occasionally, you know, waking people up to the fact that they have a gap that maybe they didn't recognize before. So when I think about the moments that I'm proud of working here, when I think about what our team is uniquely great at, and when I think about honestly the stuff that I have the most fun doing, it's that duality of the job. It's having a strong opinion and building the conviction of the stuff that just seems to work and mastering the basics, but it's getting good at translating it into the situational handwriting that every company is going to be a little different, and your approach should honor and respect that.
Yeah. I mean, when I think about you guys, just from the outside looking in, again, going back to that finish the work the founder started, in that pre-diligence, I'm imagining one of the most important things is making sure you can align with that leader, right? Like, who is that founder? What are they looking to get out of this partnership? And then, yes, you're going to go analyze the rest of it and you're going to put your playbook in place. And that's what I'd like to hear about next. So tell us about that playbook. It sounds pretty formulaic, but also variable depending on the team.
I kind of think about our playbook First of all, everyone says there's a playbook, like there's this singular leather bound tome in the middle of the office that they go back to and flip through when it's time to do stuff inside the portfolio. Spoiler, it doesn't exist here. It doesn't exist anywhere. When I think about the stuff that we've written down and the work that we repeatedly do inside of our companies, the first lens that I would look at it through is kind of, I don't know. My favorite biography of all time is Bill Walsh's book. He coached the 49ers, took them from not so great to one of the best football teams of all time. I also think he has one of the best biography titles of all time. The Score Takes Care of Itself. And I think that idea is so true, certainly in sports. I think so in business. And when I think back to my experience on a sales team, and it's now been, you know, 10 years or more since that first, you know, transformative character building BDR experience, my good months and my bad months, like, they have a lot in common. The good months, when I focused on the right people to call and I hit my activity targets and I prepped so my pitch was high quality, like, surprise, I usually hit my number. And the months that I didn't hit my number, what did I do? I sprayed and prayed, I got distracted, didn't get my touches in, and I didn't prep, and my pitch wasn't as tight as it should be. And, you know, big surprise, I missed. And I think you can look at growth the same way that Bill Walsh looks at the process of winning a football game. When you're doing the little things right, like, the results kind of take care of themselves. And I think that's true at a company level. So for us, growth is kind of an equation, the way that we think about it. And growth to us is sort of equal to a combination of focus, quantity, and quality. Like, if you nail a niche and you really decide who the customers are that you want to disproportionately delight, if you focus on having some rigor around tracking how many touches and conversations and meetings you have with those people and get really clear on what a good month and a bad month looks like, and you train your team and you prepare your team and you make your team really confident so that the next conversation that they have everything they need to shine and stand out, good things tend to happen. So my growth playbook is built around those three principles: focus, quantity, and quality. We start with building an ICP. We translate that into a target account list. We start with setting some very basic targets around top of funnel and our pipeline and what we want to see. And we build a system that tells us whether we're on track or off track. That's all built around the principle of less data, more often. Like, we're not going to ask you for a 100-page reporting template. We want you to answer 5 questions, but answer those questions honestly. And then quality is just usually investing in the training and coaching and playbook building inside the company. That it's not that it's not there inside of the companies that we invest in. It's just there existing in kind of a tribal knowledge inside of people's heads format, which lets it be used, but doesn't let it be shared and deployed and iterated on in the same way as if you had it written down. So that's kind of the first lens on our playbook is, I think growth is an equation. Growth is equal to focus, quantity, and quality. And if you generally raise the bar on those three factors inside of a company, you're probably going to wake up with a higher bookings number later on if you do those things correctly.
Yeah, I think that's very logical, right? And when you're talking to a business owner, often, not always, they've spent their career building a company and they aren't as savvy. Not they're not smart, but they're not as experienced in choosing P firm A versus P firm B, right? Some of it's easy, the valuation, et cetera, right? But if you're looking for a partner over the long haul, part of it is getting that opportunity and why you're different and why you're unique. Unique's a tough word, but, you know, meaningfully differentiated. So that's part of what that is. And so one of the questions is, you know, how do you get smarter on whether the executive is picking up what you're putting down? Because if all they're worried about is valuation, they're leaving, that's probably not the right sort of, maybe, but it's probably not the right sort of opportunity. So, and sometimes you get a book or a SIM or a PPM from a banker and everything looks pretty and it's in the top right quadrant and it's going like crazy. So how do you sort of cut through wheat and the chaff sort of approach to determining if this management team really cares? Because I imagine that's part of your IC memo, which is, this team is good and we want to back them because we've learned that. And so that's part one. Then part two is, yeah, you get someone who's excited and they're on board and you buy the company. things go wrong. And things go wrong for thousands, except for you guys. But, you know, it's market conditions. It's all sorts of things. So how do you determine if there's a fit in the beginning? And then if and when things go sideways, how do you get it back on track?
I mean, we make these decisions together. So, you know, I won't pretend to get inside everyone's head at our firm and kind of summarize that at a simple level, because I think it's sort of impossible to do. I think one of the things that makes us good at what we do, and one of the things that makes me excited to talk about whether we're going to do a deal or not, is we make that decision together. And it's a conversation. It's not one person leading that and kind of, you know, pile driving that through a process. I can tell you when I start to get excited early in a deal situation. And I start to get excited when we're meeting the management team, when they're talking about the things that they've done that make them proud, but there's an energy around talking about the gaps that exist in the business and just the things that they haven't gotten to yet. And so when there's a defensiveness around those things, when there's kind of a stiff arm, like, hey, let's not talk about the stuff that's jammed in the closet that we know is, you know, probably rotting or problematic, I start to get a little bit worried, not only about the health of the business, but, you know, the receptiveness of the management team to self-critique and to spot gaps and fill them. When we start to have conversations around just what have you done and what have you not gotten to yet, and you sort of naturally get into this brainstorming / solving mode around, oh yeah, this is something that we'll admit that we haven't nailed, or that we've tried and that we failed at, or that we just haven't even gotten to yet. And people are actually excited to lay it all out on the table and admit where the gaps are because they see the potential of filling those gaps. That I think is both a really good sign for the strength of the potential relationship, but also like the DNA of the management team. Because I firmly believe that the number one predictor of a strong business and a strong management team is, can you talk about the stuff that's broken behind not going well? I say this all the time, you can't fix a secret. And if you're not willing to talk about the things that aren't going well, it is impossible to fix those things. I'm in the business of fixing things. I enjoy fixing things, and I want to work with people who have that same energy around pointing out the stuff that's holding them back instead of trying to obscure it because they're trying to protect their profile or trying to, I don't know, accomplish some other agenda.
The "your kid's never ugly" approach is really challenging for an entrepreneur. You know, you get to a point where you want to grow this thing, you want a PE firm to come in and help you. You're going to have to be able to be a little vulnerable and look in the corner and say, you know what? I need to fix this. And there are some people that just will not get there.
And forget PE for a second. Like, I think this is true in business. I think it's true in life. If people want to read something that articulates this better than I ever will, there's a guy named Nico Connor, N-I-K-O, who started a consulting firm called Incandescent. And he wrote an article called The Red Test. And it's exactly about this thing. Like the number one test, if you could go in and observe one quality of a management team and say, are these folks going to actually accomplish something great? It's, do they have a method for getting the things that are red, the things that are broken behind not being accomplished, out on the table, working through them and taking stances on them? And by the way, the stance can be do nothing. Like, it's not time yet. We don't have the resources, or this isn't a priority. But the point is, you're talking about it and you're surfacing it, because when you build a system that surfaces those things, this is what I try to accomplish with my sales metric stuff. You don't have to have that moment of tension and moment of truth where you're doing the calculus about whether you should speak up about this thing, right? Because the environment that you work in surfaces it for you. And this like courageousness of bringing up the tough issue doesn't exist anymore, because it's being synthetically surfaced in a way where people don't have to worry about whether they should bring it up. They should just focus on solving the frickin' problem, which is when good stuff starts to happen.
Yeah, that's right. I think a lot of people do fear that. I mean, we saw it in my former life as a banker, putting together material and only talking about the good stuff. And sometimes setting up a company to look pretty could to get a higher valuation, as opposed to just saying, listen, here's what's good and here's what's bad. And I think that transparency sets you free. And That's a great thing. And it comes back to the point that if there's an executive, a founder that's running a business and wants that, okay, that's why this sort of a PE firm is different than this sort of a PE firm, and someone who's going to celebrate those things is positive. So it's nice to hear you guys are focused on it. It's just, I don't know, it's sort of like, it's a relief when you can talk about something that's not going well, because there's a, how do I bring in the resources to help you change it?
Yeah. And we always have a moment in the first year of an investment where somebody goes there without us pressing on it. And we make a big point to give that person a huge high five for bringing up the problem, because that's how we make progress. And if you start to recognize that behavior of putting the problem on the table, bringing up the thing that's not going well, like raising your hand and surfacing the risk, it starts to become this muscle that you build inside the company, not just at the management team level, but throughout. And that's when the good stuff really starts to happen. So it's about looking for that DNA that is naturally there with the management team, but it's also about, I don't know, like recognizing it when it comes up, so it happens a little more consistently. Cause again, you can do a lot of tactics and sales and marketing and finance and all that, but if the one thing that we could improve is a company's ability to bring up the things that are broken or need fixing, I would pick that thing all day long.
So we've talked about your background. We've talked about the strategy at the firm level. Let's talk about the portfolio today. It's a challenging environment, especially being a growth company in the public markets. Look at the growth companies. Growth at all costs, see you later. When's it coming back? I don't know. You need profitable growth. What are you looking for right now? What are your companies needing the most help with?
It's a weird time, right? Because like for the last couple of years, I think you've seen what you hinted at, like growth at all costs was the thing. And it was okay if you were burning a bunch of cash, if you were growing 20, 30, 40, 50, 100%. Spoiler, that isn't the case anymore. I'm very late to surfacing that narrative, but it's the truth. And there has been this huge shift to more profitable growth. Everybody's asking about efficiency, profitability. That's a different headset than people were using the last couple of years. So what are people saying? It's scary out there. Money isn't cheap anymore. Interest rates are up. Nobody's buying anything. On the sales side, if you're working a deal, you're going to have to drag yourself in front of a CFO and they're going to listen to your pitch and they're going to give you that scary thumbs up, thumbs down thing from Gladiator and tell you if you're going to win the deal or not. The interesting question is that true? For your company, is that true? I think there's a lot of folks out there who are accepting that narrative and kind of soaking in that swimming pool and aren't doing the work to understand what the impact has been to their business specifically, right? So chances are, yes, it's gotten tougher. Chances are maybe your win rates are down or your close rates are down or you're creating fewer opportunities or whatever the thing is. But I would just implore people, and I've done some writing about this, is do a little bit of a diagnostic exercise and figure out what that means for your business. What has the impact actually been? Because there is power in that diagnosis, and that can tell you what levers make the most sense for you to pull. So something as simple as like pull all the opportunities you've created every quarter for the last six quarters. Notice how long they've taken to close, how many have closed, whether that customer segmentation looks any different. That can be done in a day, and it can tell you a lot about what the impact has been on your business specifically, so that you don't just accept this prevailing narrative as the truth. I'll tell you, you know, there's a couple of things that we're doing inside the portfolio that people are both asking us for help for and that we're kind of recommending that people do. One is just a tighter operating cadence. I would just say like what we used to look at monthly, we now look at weekly. And I spent a lot of time designing a very lightweight reporting pack that our sales and marketing leaders now produce every single week. And the reporting that we use at the fund level is the same reporting that they use inside the company. And it's designed to answer a couple just really important questions. How do you feel about the quarter? Not like lick your finger and stick it in the air, but like, what is pipeline coverage and how is that changing? And let's look at it from several different angles, including how did we do last year? What are the deals that really matter? So we can keep an eye on not just how those are progressing, but how can we help? And like, are we creating enough new pipeline for future quarters? There's a lot of companies out there that have never taken the time to set or to decide what is a good week for new opportunity creation. And did we have a good week last week or not? So all of this is just designed to get the company out of running things on the go-to-market side, away from running it via gut instinct and more towards, you know, more numerical rigor. And I would say, don't start from scratch. A lot of our companies are looking for help. Like, hey, we do need to make up a hole in our pipeline. We do need to create more opportunities. Like, who doesn't want more pipeline shown to me? And I'll be interested to study that example. But customer segmentation in terms of looking for little pockets of potential customers or prospects that might be more interested or might close quicker than average. So I'm spending a lot of time right now looking at, hey, how do we connect with people who were closed lost opportunities from the last couple of years? How do we look for people who could be potential referrals? How could we look for people who are our existing customer base that we're not just doing enough with? You know, there's all these little pockets of potential demand that if ignored, you know, they're not going to progress. But when you're behind, you need to look for little places where, like, instead of how can we cook some pipeline from scratch, like how can we reheat some pipeline that can be ready and on the table in 30 minutes instead of 3 hours from now?
Yeah, and a lot of that's probably messaging, right? Like, I think about even at Resourcive, for the longest time, 15 years probably, before I even joined, it was all spend reduction. Then, you know, being in big PE, they were very focused on growth. So we had to pivot what we did. We were still doing spend reduction, but it was very much, I had to lead with growth enablement. That's what we're here to do. Force multiplication. Well, guess what? Same PE firms that wanted growth enablement 3 years ago, 2 years ago, were saying, Nick, I want that no cost savings again. So I'm pivoting back, you know, and you have to be able to understand what that ICP is actually looking for and then being able to articulate that without changing your business, but just changing the messaging a little bit. And that's where you get to that reheating rather than refinding.
Well, totally. And early in a deal, even a first conversation or a cold call, like, again, this is a regression. Any company that we invest in has worked with usually hundreds of customers who have evaluated other solutions and said yes to ours. And there's gold in the pattern matching of your existing customer base. So, like, I spend a lot of time on positioning and building pitch decks and building messaging. And I always add this page to everyone's pitch deck, which is, we'll talk about the product in a second, but let's talk about the flavor of the inbound call that we typically get. And there's, you know, I'm an ex-consultant, so there's always three on the slide, but it's like, hey, when people call us, they're typically in situation A, situation B, situation C. And this is what they're trying to accomplish. And this is what gets in the way, right? So which one of these resonates the most with you? Because to your point, like, it's hard to know early in a conversation if someone is focused more on time savings, on cost savings, on productivity, like, insert source of value here. I like to think of it like, even if you go to an amazing restaurant and you sit down at a table and a waiter comes over and says, what do you want to eat? If I haven't gotten a menu at that point, that's an anxiety-inducing situation for me because I have no idea what the art of the possible is. And I have no idea what you're uniquely great at. And I have to guess, and I might waste my time and money if you don't show me what's on the menu. So whenever possible, especially early in sales conversations, my coaching to my team is show people what's on the menu. Show people who show up and choose to work with you why they do that and how they articulate the problems. Because chances are with a new prospect or a new customer, they're going to stare at that page. And when they start laughing, you know, you got them because you've articulated what their problem is from the standpoint of someone who just looks just like them, instead of here's what we sell, here's how it works. By the way, here's exactly how it works. Do you want to buy some? Which nobody likes that.
Yeah. I think, you know, one of the things that we always ask for when trying to determine if a business is right, we ask for when trying to determine if an operating partner is right, we ask when trying to determine the CEO, CFO, C-suite. You said it and sort of brings it all together, is intellectual curiosity and humility, right? So if you possess those two things in any role, it's going to allow you to ask better questions. It's going to allow you to appreciate can't fix a secret. It's going to allow you to sort of put those sort of the red test together. Like, so those are the things that we're always looking for. It sounds like you all are doing a good job of teasing those out and allowing the management teams to feel comfortable that if their sort of their mindset is that way, intellectual curiosity and humility, then they're going to be the sort of right fit for you. So it's nice to see that all come together and you know, appreciate you bringing a lot of the practical implications of how to do that to the theoretical need of we need to improve things. And you know, that's sort of what we're hoping this podcast is all about and what you brought to bear here.
Yeah. And it's always much more smooth and linear and easy when you talk about it in a format like this. But to your point, if you have an environment where it's easier to bring up the things that are broken or not going well or need fixing, the relationship gets stronger too, right? Because all the research on psychological safety would back this up. Like the number one predictor of a lot of teams is, you know, whether you call it the red test or ability to speak up about things or whatever it is, there's two benefits to that. Like things get better faster when you surface problems, but you get closer with the people that you're working with too, because you're vulnerable together, you're figuring stuff out together, and you're doing that as a team and not trying to, you know, hide something over here by yourself so that nobody sees it. That's what makes this job fun. Like at the end of the day, we can't do anything unless we do it with our management teams. And if we create an environment where they know that they're recognized and rewarded for surfacing things that are off track, we get closer as a result. And it's those relationships. Like, yeah, you can point to the line chart that goes up and to the right. You can point to a great exit. You can point to all the typical private equity results as the stuff that you're proud of on your resume. But at the end of the day, it's the relationships with the people inside of the companies who are actually making it happen. Like, that's the stuff I'm proud of personally.
Yeah, hopefully a lot of people that are listening can get a benefit from that if they're owners of business. I think hearing what you're offering is anxiety reducing, because it's hopefully not just about, yeah, right, about let me just, you know, how do I maximize the last eighth of a turn of EBITDA? It's more of how do I find the right partner? And so it's nice to hear you guys do that. And it's what, you know, Nick and I are trying to do collectively within this ecosystem of, you know, private equity and value creation. So, you know, it's great to have you with us and looking forward to, you know, hoping this conversation sparks a lot of interest from folks going forward.
Yeah. Well, thanks for having me, guys. This was fun. Enjoyed it.
Thanks, man. Hopefully you guys enjoyed that. I thought it was a great conversation. One of the things that I want to ask you, Scott, is looking at Paul's background, relatively young guy. He was a professional lacrosse player for a minute. Then he was a VP of sales. Then he went to Bain as a consultant. Now he's an operating partner. Is there a common path or theme that you see when you're working with operating partners? I know a lot of them are former operators, but this kind of strikes me as a little bit of a unique transition into it, especially from a sales perspective.
Yeah, I mean, there's lots of traditional and untraditional paths to every job, right? So I think from an operating partner, it used to be we never talk about age, we never talk about sort of backgrounds, but, 75-year-old white guy who worked at GE and, sort of helped around the edges. Now it's age agnostic, background agnostic. The key is, can you add value? And so I think, Paul's an example of someone who didn't, and we didn't ask him this, but, imagine him grow up saying, I can't wait to be an operating partner. But I think where you find a lot of talent is someone who's done something where they've had to create value on their own. He did that with, ITG and, selling whatever equity research, right? At a time when maybe everyone didn't need it. So we had to fight through that. And then he went into Bain. And whether it's Bain or BCG or any consulting shop, having 4, 5, 6 years of having to sell something thoughtfully and solve problems is super helpful. But then the key from there is actually going out and doing it. Because you need to transition often from just giving advice in a consulting shop to eating your own cooking. And so he's done a nice job of going and transitioning into a role where they said, listen, help us do what you're already doing for us at Bain with our portfolio of companies. And another way that people get into it is they're in a company itself. And maybe it's a COO, right? Or someone who's in operations. And then that person can flip and say, listen, my go-to-market strategy, my digital transformation, I've actually had to do things to increase the value of a company. Now the private equity firms need that operational insight because you can't just financially engineer your way to returns. You need to actually do something with the asset and do something meaning improve it operationally.
Yeah, I thought it was a great conversation. I really like talking sales. A lot of times, especially in PE, when you're talking to PE folks, like you kind of hide from that word almost. We're all kind of in sales, right? Like you and me especially. But, you know, it's interesting to hear his perspective of how he's helping portfolio companies drive growth. I think that hopefully that shares a unique perspective. And you know, the thing about this podcast, we say it every week, we're talking to people with diverse backgrounds. They have, you know, kind of done it all. And our goal is to collectively bring thought leaders around the space to hopefully give our listeners that unique perspective, depending on whoever we're speaking to. And we got another one coming up next, another operator with a manufacturing background. So looking forward to that as well.
Yep. I think that's, you're right on. I think it's the backgrounds used to matter a ton in terms of went to this school and did this and is a glide path towards quote unquote success. I think, you know, helpfully, it's all about creating value. It's not that cutting costs are easy. They're not. But they're a heck of a lot easier than growth. And so that's right. Why the sales lens is so important. And, you know, not all revenue dollars are created equal. So being thoughtful about the right sort of sales and the right sort of margin. But I think you're spot on. And hopefully these are, well, they're interesting to us. Hopefully they're interesting to other people too.
Exactly. That's great. All right. Well, we'll be back again with another one coming up shortly.